You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and Steelworkers District 11. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions, representing 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in Greater Kansas City, in the Greater Kansas City community. And United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And on tonight's show, we'll have revolutionary poet, musician, and citizen journalist Eleanor Goldfield, who will discuss NAFTA, workers' rights, fighting the man, and the power of art to change the world. Then, Missouri, Kansas, and other states are passing laws to block activism for peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We'll take a closer look at the connection between our freedom of speech and an issue that never seems to go away. In the news, the Trump NLRB obliterates its predecessor's best decisions, and Missouri minimum wage to go up next week. Our feature at the end of the show will be a review of the year with Mark Grunberg in Washington Window on Workers. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, December 28th, 2017. Mark Joseph Stern, writing in Slate, says the National Labor Relations Board was not designed to veer wildly each time the presidency changes, but that's just what's happening with the Trump administration. He says it is engaged in a full-fledged legal assault on unions that's poised to wreak havoc on collective bargaining. The National Labor Relations Board is an independent agency tasked with encouraging the practice and procedure of collective bargaining. Under the Trump administration, however, it appears to have adopted a new mission: to incinerate every Obama-era rule as quickly as possible. This month, the NLRB issued a staggering five decisions overturning union-friendly rules that the agency had either enacted or strengthened under President Barack Obama. Beyond the long-term goal of upending labor law to favor employers, the NLRB has a short-term reason for its anti-union blitz. Last fall, Trump added two Republicans for five-year terms to the board. They joined Philip Misamara, a Republican whom Trump had previously chosen as chairman, to create a GOP majority. But Ms. Amara's own five-year term ended December 16th, and until Trump appoints a new member, the board will be deadlocked 2-2. So with startling speed, the GOP majority laid waste to the decisions that refocused the agency on workers' rights under Obama. First, the board overturned a 2016 decision requiring settlements to provide a full remedy to aggrieved workers. Second, the board reversed a 2004 decision bolstering workers' rights to organize free from unlawful employer interference. Third, the board overturned a watershed 2015 decision holding employers responsible for bargaining with workers if they have indirect control over those workers' employment or have the ability to exercise control. That's the famous McDonald's is a joint employer with franchisees case. Fourth, the board reversed a 2016 decision safeguarding unionized workers' rights to bargain over changes in employment terms. And fifth, the board overturned another 2011 decision protecting the prerogative of a group of employees within a larger company to form a bargaining unit. All of these rulings were issued in 1 week, the last week of Ms. Amara's term. Each of them was a 3-2 decision, with Republicans in the majority and Democrats dissenting. Taken together, this spate of decisions will hinder millions of employees' abilities to unionize and bargain collectively.
Matt at CNN Money reports that CEOs may like the idea of a big tax cut for businesses, but that doesn't mean they'll use the savings to create American jobs. Just 14% of CEOs surveyed by Yale University said that their companies plan to make large, immediate capital investments in the United States now that the tax overhaul has been passed. Capital investments, like building plants and upgrading equipment, can lead to hiring. Only a slim majority of the CEOs, that's 55%, said that the Republican tax package should be signed into law. The Yale CEO Summit surveyed 110 prominent business leaders of Fortune 500 and Fortune 50 companies last week. The findings, along with other surveys, suggest that the tax plan may not have the dramatic impact on jobs that President Trump and Republicans in Congress have promised.
If there isn't a lot of good news for working people at the end of the year, there's at least one good thing that will happen in Missouri as soon as 2017 ends. The state's minimum wage will go up. In fact, in 12 states, minimum wage workers will get a raise. They are in Alaska, Florida, Hawaii, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, New Jersey, Ohio, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and Vermont. Still, all will remain below $12 an hour. Missouri's will go from $7.70 to $7.85, and the minimum for tipped workers will go up to $3.93. That's because back in 2006, through the initiative process, the citizens of Missouri overwhelmingly raised the state's minimum wage, pegged it to the rising cost of living, and raised the minimum for tipped workers to half of the regular minimum. Arizona, California, Colorado, Maine, New York, and Washington are instituting one phase of a gradual increase that will eventually reach either $12 or $15 an hour after multiple phases are complete. That would have happened here in Kansas City and in St. Louis if the state legislature hadn't preempted Missouri's cities from raising their minimum wages. That's why Missouri's Jobs with Justice is repeating what it did with the 2006 initiative. It's gathering signatures across the state to get on next November ballot to proposal to raise the state's minimum to $12 by 2023. The campaign is called Raise Up Missouri. If you'd like to sign the petition and are a Missourian registered voter, call Kansas City Jobs with Justice at 816-753-0689. Also, you don't have to be a Missouri resident to help gather signatures. Just call Jobs with Justice to volunteer.
More than 5,000 U.S. workers, 14 every day, were fatally injured on the job in 2016, a 7% increase from the year before. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and PAI report, PAI News Service. The 5,190 deaths in 2016 were up from 4,836 the year before to 3.6 deaths per 100,000 full-time workers, up from 3.4 in 2015. The injury rate also rose. Peg Seminario, the AFL-CIO's veteran director of occupational safety and health, said, "For many groups of workers in this country, work is becoming more dangerous and deadly. The number of dead is the most since 2008 and the highest rate since 2010, she said. But Seminario also noted there's a big split in the numbers. Where the Occupational Safety and Health Administration concentrates money, staff, and inspections, death rates stayed stable or dropped. But growing economic sectors, which receive little attention and oversight, such as healthcare and food services, saw jumps in death rates on the job. The same is true for groups of workers that lack OSHA protection, including state and local government employees and many agricultural workers, she noted. Healthcare, food services, and state and local governments are all majority female occupations, and agriculture, especially among farm workers, has a high female share. There was a 40% rise in fatal occupational injuries in bars and restaurants, again, a majority female occupation, along with a 20% hike among state government workers and 13% increase in local government job-related deaths. The bar and restaurant figures included a 64% hike in deaths among food preparers and servers. They're not just cutting themselves, I'm sure. Overall, 387 women suffered fatal on-the-job injuries in 2016, 12.5% more than the 344 the year before. That's almost double the percentage hike for men. Still, far more men die on the job, 4,803 in 2016, up from 4,492 in 2015. One reason for the increases, Seminario reiterated, is OSHA's lack of enough inspectors to really do its job. She said, federal OSHA now has fewer than 800 inspectors and can inspect workplaces on average only once every 159 years. OSHA's budget has declined since 2010 and been frozen for years. House Republicans are now seeking big cuts for 2018. Fewer resources and less oversight will mean more injuries and workplace deaths. Workers need more safety and health protection, not less, she said. As usual, transportation at 40% of deaths and construction at 20% accounted for a large share of the on-the-job fatal injuries, and both sectors saw increases in 2016. Overall deaths from falls has risen by 25% since 2011. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Jeff Humfeld, Tino Scalisi, and I'm Judy Ansel.
And that was Chains at the beginning of the segment with Eleanor Goldfield and her group Rooftop Revolutionaries. And this next segment coming up is Eleanor, and she's going to be reading to us a poem from her new book, Paradigm Lost, and then following that with an interview. And so I'd like to welcome everybody in the Heartland Labor Forum audience and everybody in Kansas City. Hope you're having a merry holidays and all of that. And welcome back.
Call me an anarchist, socialist, commie, leftist, because you don't know the difference. But all those words sound scary. When you call me un-American, what you're really saying is that I'm anti-war, not brainwashed or whitewashed. This is what I stand for. Outside of party lines, repeat offender of thought crimes. Humanity over oligarchy. Fist up if you follow me. Not like sheeple, but people. Think for yourselves. Rise up and rebel. Take to the streets and meet me at the corner of freedom and justice. In this fight, it's just us. Ain't no savior or prayer that can lift us up. So drag your gods from their man-made thrones. Throw them out of the clouds onto the ground and watch how they quake in the wake of reality. Like a flickering TV, weaker as you, the creator grows stronger. Unplug and stand up, switch homicide for deicide, drop your idols, grab hold of humanity. rise. Let apathy fall by the wayside. You don't need it, that drug. Don't let it define you. Not one more line of God's will shrugs and brain spills rebel. Because you know it's the only way that this will get better. Forget keep calm. We're yelling, propelling forward, putting people over profit, planet, and peace, over putrid holes filled with cheap plastic, bombastic, nationalistic shows of a hollow pride. Yes, we need outcries at least, trials for war crimes instead of libraries named for trigger-happy fools, illiterate tools who couldn't spell their way out of elementary school, where children left behind seek heil to Monopoly Men on High, learn how to stay in line and count time based on 8-hour workdays, 365. And yet as we toil, our minds shrink and spoil. Well below average, like Forrest Gump, just a hunch. But maybe those trillions we spend bombing and drilling could go into filling our kids with knowledge. But that's American exceptionalism. Number one at war, we're good at killing people. Number forget science and math and everything else. Excelling at failing, freedom derailing. Think closing your eyes will keep us from crashing. As we roll, just rehashing all the mistakes that dug us this grave. Am I insane to think blood mixed with oil will stain our future, our name, our hearts, and our brains? That the poison born of Agent Orange shouldn't be sprayed on our food? We stack alms the steeple while people just outside starve in the corners they carved from a precious foundation founded on hope and change, crumbling and stumbling. These facades can't save us for long. So, isn't it strange that patriots named for every war waged, these freedom crusades that make us less safe, less free, and less brave, and we, those for peace and a life without chains, are un-American. Me, socialist scum, feminist destroyer of American dreams.
Ah! Now, so why can't we have entertainment like that? Like, why can't I go out at night and go and hear a poem like that so moving? It inspires me. Eleanor, thank you so much for that. And for those of you that are just tuning in and listening, we are talking to Eleanor Goldfield again. I mentioned that earlier. This is her new book, Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift. And in it, you will find, gosh, just a whole plethora of poems and missives, just very much like the one that you read, just as powerful. Eleanor, I was watching something that you did when the Trump Care debate was coming out. It was something that you did on RT. I can't remember the show exactly, but you're into all sorts of different things. You're not just a creative person, but you're also into politics. Can you tell me about some of the other things that you do outside of poetry?
Sure. So I mean, the creative is very much tied to the political. They're not. For me, they're not two separate issues. They exist together constantly. So I sort of go between issues wherever I'm needed most at the moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm kind of tired because we occupied the FCC.
I'm sorry, what did you say? You did what?
So we occupied outside the FCC, so we slept outside, and well, I put sleep in quotation marks, but. So I kind of do whatever issues need me at the moment, and I sort of bounce around to different issues and different organizations and see how I can best help them, both as a creative but also as a journalist and an organizer. So I try to get the message out. I try to help with messaging, and I try to organize on the ground as well. So a lot of different actions at the same time, but art is a very integral part of all of those things.
Sure. And can you tell us that, did you have any sort of formal training in organizing or journalism or anything like that? Or is that just something that you've sort of come to naturally?
No, I mean, in terms of organizing, I feel that oftentimes the best training is doing it, because I think, you know, it's almost like an apprenticeship. It's like, are you going to read a book on welding, or are you going to go out there and like have somebody show you that's an expert? And I feel like it's the same thing with organizing, because I think that a lot of these big NGOs, they end up being a little out of touch with the people on the ground because they don't actually connect with them.
Right.
But the best people are the ones that are that are organizing from their own communities, because they know what it's like to live in that community. They know what it's like to live by the chemical plant or to live with police brutality or what have you.
Right.
So really the best organizers are the ones who just started doing it because they felt that they had to. They organize with people that they know. They organize in cultures that they understand, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of journalism, I never had formal training as a journalist. I went to really good schools growing up. I dropped out of college, but writing was something that I did constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'd already started writing articles for pro audio magazines because I was a studio tech in Los Angeles for a while.
Uh-huh.
So I was writing articles on like here's how you fix your cables or whatever, and then when Occupy happened, I started helping out with the media there.
Sure.
In Los Angeles, and that sort of snowballed into what I do today.
Well, that's kind of funny that you mentioned this, because I was actually talking to a local, he's fairly high up in the echelons of the progressive community in Kansas City, who said that we're talking about this certain program that was going away in Kansas City that was really integral to working people in Kansas City. And the response was, well, what good does protest do? Like, Tino, do you remember the Occupy movement, whatever that was? What did that really do? What did that really accomplish? To articulate that, you just basically said what that did. I mean, I think it turned a lot of people on to do activism. I mean, that sounds like it was very much the case with you.
Well, I mean, I was an activist before then. I
Sure.
started doing activism when I was like 14 or 15, and I started with environmental activism. And then before the second Iraq War in 2002, I did a lot of anti-war organizing. And then as I continued, I realized that all of these issues are interconnected mm-hmm. under the oligarchical system that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when I started kind of bouncing around to these issues, because I felt that, you know, the connectivity is really important. And I think that something the left loses a lot of times is the connectivity between our battles. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement is integrally tied to the environmental movement, is incredibly tied to the Fight for 15 movement, is tied to the, you know, all of these movements have a common denominator, and I think it's really important that we recognize that so that we can progress forward as opposed to try and like singularly press forward with limited resources and people.
Well, what do you think that it is that keeps people sort of disconnected? I think that you and I talked very briefly, and my gosh, if I had the opportunity to sit down for 6 or 7 hours with you and just sort of hash these things out, I got this. But I'm just telling everybody that in the listening audience that I got this great email that was just pages and pages and pages long, and I just thought, oh man. Anyway, so in that, we were talking about, you know, what it is that keeps people disconnected and keeps people from having these conversations. I think I mentioned the different technologies that we have, the handheld phones and the Candy Crush saga and the all of these things that keep people sort of isolated, and how this new technology can actually help people get connected. But what is it that you think like is keeping people, like, say, working people in Kansas City or people who are listening now, what keeps them from sort of coming together and recognizing those commonalities and fighting against a common enemy?
Well, I think a lot of it is by design. You know, the concept divide et impera, divide and conquer, is something that people have been talking about since Thomas Jefferson's time, which is one of the primary reasons, well, not primary, but one of the reasons that we expanded west, was because we figured that, oh, wow, well, what a great way to divide and conquer if we just spread ourselves out over 3,000 miles. And you see that very much today. There is no American community. You know, you go to some
sure.
place like Iceland, of course, there's a more of a community feel because there are like 12 people that live there and they're on a small island. You know, it's the same thing with Sweden. Sweden has fewer people than the city of New York.
Right.
So there's more of like a Swedish feel. And I'm not pro-nationalist. I'm pro-community.
Right.
But I think that with the American idea, I think it's so abstract and obtuse. And so when people hear something like, well, I'm a white working man, for example, and I hear that the immigrants are coming over and stealing our jobs. Well, if I hear that enough, I won't question, well, is it the corporatists that are giving them those jobs because they're cheaper to pay than me? Should I be angry at them instead? So
right.
I think it's a two-prong issue. One is that we get our information filtered through these corporate media outlets,
yeah.
or we don't look for alternatives online. But also, there is, unfortunately, a rise in this anti-intellectualism. That there's a rise in not wanting to question. And some of that is by design in terms of people having to work three jobs to survive.
Sure.
When you get home for your 5 hours of sleep, you're not going to Google, who's screwing me over, the government or Jose? Like, that's just not part of your, day-to-day.
Yeah.
And the other part is, of course, that people, it's by design that they think that all of the information that they're getting is via Fox News. They don't need to intellectually seek out another perspective. So I think a lot of people... and a lot of the people that I work with, some of my friends, one of their primary issues is to go out to white working class communities and talk to them about this rise in white supremacy and really try to get to the bottom of their anger and see that they are more aligned with the anti-fascists in reality than they are in line with the white supremacists. So I think that this issue of outreach is really important to get to those people who are really being attacked by the system as well, and don't feel that they're forgotten and they're not getting the information necessary to really tie into what the progressives are fighting for.
Yeah, and I think that what you were talking before about, people coming together and having these conversations, especially, and not to, I don't think there's anything common at all about common people. I mean, I think that I have my most uncommon conversations when I'm in conversation with common people, with my friends at work, or people on the street. Just very rare, very sort of nuanced sort of ideas that come across. Mm-hmm. But what I don't understand is that it seems that through the years, like for example, there was something that kind of a revolutionary education program in Detroit where revolutionary black workers were forming alliances and power bases inside the factories with sort of political education, but then they were also reaching out to poor white workers from Appalachia, and they were finding their sort of common bonds. And for some reason, I don't know how it is that we've done these sorts of things before, but we've somehow are missing or losing those lessons.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely people that are doing that work, but I think sometimes and you see this with just online, like if you do a Google search for a word, it won't be the same thing that shows up on my Google search.
Really?
The Facebook that you see, if we had the same friends, wouldn't be the same Facebook. It's called the filter bubble, is what tech people call it. Hmm. So you basically only see things that you've liked before, or you see things that Facebook or Google think you'll like because they want the hits, right?
Oh.
So if I'm a white supremacist and I Google, Hitler should have killed more Jews, I'm gonna find those articles that support that perspective. I'm not gonna find somebody going, "What the hell's the matter with you?"
Right.
So I think this is also a problem. This promotes this sort of isolation and this sort of it bolsters these horrific perspectives. And I think that this is also a problem on the left, right? Like if you as somebody who deals predominantly with environmentalist work, but you want to hear about the labor movement, or you want to hear about the racial justice movement, you're not going to find that on your Facebook page, because Facebook is only going to feed you the things that you interact with the most, which is the environmental issues. So I think it's really important that I really do say, I mean, I'm a total introvert and I have social anxiety to the nth degree.
You
but
too,
I will
huh?
always say. But I will always say that there is nothing that beats face-to-face contact. There is nothing that beats actually going out into your community, into other communities, and talking to people. I grew up in North Carolina, and if you talk, I've talked to, poor white workers, and they're not, they say racist things, but if you kind of get to the bottom of it, you realize that it's not that they just hate black people inherently. There's something in there, and you can change that.
Yeah.
And granted, that's not my job anymore. I don't do that. But
yeah.
When I lived there, I would try to talk to people, be like, "So why do you feel this way about women, that they should stay in the kitchen, or why do you feel this way about like?" And if you get to the bottom of it, there's something to work with.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that particularly as white people, we have a lot of work to do in our own communities, and not
sure.
just sort of push that aside at family gatherings, oh, that's racist Uncle Bob, but talk to him about it. Talk to him about why he feels that way. And I guarantee you it will tie back to some sort of systemic issue that we can agree on is messed up, that the corporatocracy and the oligarchy is doing to us, not the more marginalized people.
Yeah. What you were saying earlier about, especially about social anxiety, because I think that we're seeing, and I don't know, I'll try not to keep coming back to this, but it's such a thing with me, especially when I go out into the community and go out, like you go to a bar and you see like 40 people that are on their telephones staring into this. It's like, well, there's real live human beings. And I don't know if like mm-hmm. Maybe we as humans we're lacking, and it's just, we're just not as great as we think that we are, and that your phones are actually far more interesting. and that could be what the hell was I talking about? Now I forget. That's not a good segue into the NAFTA thing that I was going to talk about.
Kind of is.
Yeah. So with lack of a segue into the NAFTA thing, let's talk about NAFTA. What do you can you tell us what you were the sort of work you're doing with that?
Yeah, for sure. So I think this does segue nicely into NAFTA, because we're talking mostly about working class people.
Good,
that
yeah.
have felt the brunt of NAFTA's like oppressive fallout.
Sure.
So, you know, and this is not just in the US, and I think this is another thing that people need to understand, is that there's migration coming from the South. But that's not, I mean, it's because of things like NAFTA. Like, millions of campesinos, those are peasant farmers in Mexico, have been kicked off their land and have gone to the cities looking for work, but there's not enough to support them. So what do? They keep going north. This is a very human thing, to migrate when you can't find resources. You know,
sure.
We've been doing this for millions of years. It's just that now there's so much social, political crap stacked on top of that, that it makes it far more difficult. But we see this happening here. You know, people are leaving these previously industrialized towns because there's nothing left. I mean, you can see this if you drive around certain areas, particularly in the Midwest. They're ghost towns. They're ghost towns of places that used to support families. You know, one person working for a family of four, like,
for
that
sure.
used to be a thing. Now that's literally laughable.
True enough. And speaking of, I think that we're coming close to an end here with our piece this morning. And for all of our people in the listening audience, where can they go if they want to find more information, like what you're doing with journalism, your activism, your poetry, maybe live performances? Are you still doing music? Is that something that you do?
Unfortunately, the band has sort of fizzled, as bands so often do.
Mm-hmm.
My band has been relegated to the beautiful past, but music is still out there, which I'm very proud of.
Great.
And in terms of performances, what I do now is spoken word performances combined with projected visuals, you know, for the ADD generation.
That's right.
So it's spoken word and visuals, and I have... I was just in Asheville. I'll be in Pittsburgh in January and Minneapolis in February.
Okay.
And there's more information about that on my site, which is artkillingapathy.com. And you can find out more information about all of the things that I do via that site, including my show, which airs on Free Speech TV every week. And that's called Act Out.
Eleanor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And thank you, Kansas City, for tuning in to another edition of the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi, also wishing a very special welcome home to my dear friend Megan. I hope you have a good night. Stay tuned for these messages.
Did you know underwriting KKFI's programming spreads the word about your organization or event and supports KKFI at the same time? Learn more at kkfi.org/underwriting.
On the next Thursday night special, River City Chautauqua presents A Question of Meaning, and what do I mean by that question? Featuring comments by singer-songwriter Sam Baker, linguistics professor Lisa King of the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, and philosophy professor Dr. John Simmons. That's River City Chautauqua on the Thursday night special this Thursday at 7 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Hope everyone's having a good holiday season. And today we have some important clips to fill you in on what's been going on with Congress and free speech and people trying to bring some peace to the Middle East. Want to take a quick moment to give a shout out to the Kansas City Public Library, which had a big year this year in terms of protecting free speech, especially on this issue. They had a case against them dismissed that involved a protester asking some kind of unusual questions, sort of off base, but the reality is It's a free country, and you should be free to speak about matters that matter to you, even if your opinions are a little different. So today we're going to talk about how some new laws are coming up into play in 2018 that will impact free speech, not only for people who advocate for human rights for Palestinians, but also potentially extending beyond that. So I hope you'll enjoy the show. We'll start with a clip from one of our favorite shows, Democracy Now!
Boycott Act would make it a felony for U.S. citizens to support boycotts of Israel and Israeli settlements, punishable by at least a $250,000 fine with a maximum penalty of a fine of $1 million and 20 years in prison. So far, 46 senators, 31 Republican, 15 Democrat, and 234 Congress members from both sides of the aisle support the legislation. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, known as AIPAC, reportedly helped craft the bill and has made its passage one of the group's top lobbying priorities for the year. In a letter Monday, the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, urged senators to oppose the bill's passage. The ACLU wrote, quote, "We take no position for or against the effort to boycott Israel or any foreign country, for that matter. However, we do assert that the government cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, punish U.S. persons based solely on their expressed political beliefs," unquote. The bill has received backing from many prominent senators on both sides of the aisle. Democrats backing the bill include Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, both of New York, as well as Ron Wyden of Oregon, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, and Maria Cantwell of Washington. Republican backers include Ted Cruz of Texas, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, Marco Rubio of Florida. The BDS movement was born in 2005 when a coalition of Palestinian civil society groups called for people all over the world to engage in a nonviolent campaign to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel until it complies with international law. Their call was inspired by the international boycott and divestment initiatives applied to South Africa in the struggle to abolish apartheid. The attempt to criminalize the BDS movement comes amidst a deepening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where Israeli-imposed restrictions continue to limit electricity to between 2 and 4 hours a day for Gaza's more than 2 million residents. Gaza's been under Israeli siege for more than a decade. In 2012, the World Health Organization warned Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020. But now, the UN says, the living conditions in Gaza have deteriorated faster than expected, and the UN says the area has already become unlivable. Rabbi Berman, J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace take different positions on BDS, but on this you share a position.
Thank you for having me, Amy. Good morning. This legislation is seeking to make it illegal for businesses to comply with a boycott of Israel or Israeli settlements that is supported by an international governmental organization like the United Nations. And I think it's trying to preempt what we're supposed to see in the coming months, a database from the United Nations that lists companies that are engaged in commerce in settlements, in illegal settlements in the West Bank. And we recently had a call from Amnesty International that said that third-party states like the United States or the EU should ban settlement products from coming into the country. And so it's trying to preempt actions like this. And so instead of trying to oppose the illegal and harmful settlements, right, these settlements which are incredibly destructive for Palestinians that steal their land and force them from their homes, this legislation is instead trying to shift decades of U.S. policy and understanding that settlements are illegal according to international law and according to the United States. I want to be very clear also about what this legislation is not. It would not make it illegal for activists to support the Palestinian-led call for boycott and divestment, or for activists to decide, I'm not going to buy this product from Israel or the settlements because it is connected to injustice. This legislation, as I understand it, is focused on businesses or those engaged in commerce who might comply with a boycott that comes from the United Nations or from the EU, an international governmental organization. I don't want activists out there to think, oh, if this passes, I'm going to go to jail, because there's already a chilling effect that people are scared to speak out for Palestinian human rights, and we need to continue to speak out for Palestinian human rights.
Can you talk about where this goes from here? And talk, Rabbi Joseph Berman, about why you differ so much with AIPAC on this issue and why this they have made this a central campaign this year, the significance of AIPAC.
AIPAC is a very effective lobby, and I think in many ways they're not that different from something like the National Rifle Association, which keeps Congress from passing much-needed, incredibly reasonable gun control in this country. They enter into what is a very broken system, and they do a very good job at playing that system. They have immense resources, and they're very good at what they do, and so they're able to move legislation like this. I think it's important when we talk about AIPAC to say a couple of things. First of all, they don't speak for the Jewish community. Sometimes they might claim to, but they don't. The Jewish community, Jews in the United States, are incredibly diverse and on many ways, and especially when it comes to relationships to and views on Israel, on Israel-Palestine. And so they're not representative of American Jews, even though they might have a lot of influence. And at the same time, they are able to move this forward. I think that it's incumbent on us to have to provide a counterweight. We need to change the calculus for members of Congress so that they're not going to support legislation like this. And so if you haven't already, call the Capitol switchboard, call your member of Congress in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, tell them to oppose the legislation if it comes to a vote, to not co-sponsor if they're co-sponsoring. Tell them they need to take their names off of the legislation.
I want to turn to Vice President Mike Pence speaking this week at the Christians United for Israel Summit in Washington, D.C.
With the support and prayers of men and women gathered in this room, I'm proud to say in my last year as governor, it was my great privilege to sign one of the strongest anti-BDS laws in America to ensure that our state never does business with those who seek to inflict financial damage on Israel. Because boycott, divestment, and sanctions have no place in my home state and no place in America.
That's Mike Pence addressing the Christians United for Israel Summit in Washington, D.C.
Next up, a clip from another one of our favorite shows, The Real News Network, which everyone should check out at therealnewsnetwork.com.
It's The Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Pierce coming to you from Baltimore. Republican Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland signed an executive order on Monday that requires all firms with state contracts to promise they will not boycott Israel. In this pronouncement, Hogan said, all future state contracts would require companies to certify they will not economically discriminate against Israel, and that if any current state contractors refuse to agree, they would be terminated. The order is in response to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS movement, which is trying to put pressure on Israel to stop human rights abuses against Palestinians and to lift its occupation of Palestinian land. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign is very similar to the very effective campaign that was organized against South African apartheid some 23 years ago. There are some 21 states that has implemented similar anti-BDS laws or executive orders in the US. Another recent example that will boggle your mind is this one in Dickerson, Texas, where they have just passed a similar measure requiring people receiving Hurricane Harvey relief assistance to sign a document promising not to boycott Israel. Joining me now to discuss these anti-BDS developments in the U.S. is Dima Khalidi. She is the founder and director of Palestine Legal, an organization that protects the civil and constitutional rights of people in the U.S. who speak out for Palestinians. Thanks for joining me today, Dima.
Thanks for having me, Sharmini.
So, Dima, as I said, Governor Hogan's executive order and the state of Maryland is one of many states that have now adopted anti-BDS measures, some 21 states. Why are they doing this, and how constitutional are these positions and measures?
Well, the reason that we're seeing these now 22 laws, actually, is because of the growing effectiveness of the grassroots movement for Palestinian rights, which includes efforts to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel for its illegal activities and its decades of violations of Palestinian human rights. As we see more and more churches and student governments and even NFL players supporting boycotts for Palestinian rights, we're seeing the Israeli government, along with Israel advocacy groups in the U.S., looking for more and more ways to silence this growing grassroots movement. And so in addition to seeing this legislative assault on our right to boycott for Palestinian rights, we're also seeing all over the United States efforts to shut down the conversation about Israel-Palestine. So our work, for example, encompasses these kinds of efforts on campuses around the country, which include attacks on students, efforts to censor and punish them for protesting and speaking out and putting on events that raise awareness about Palestine. So we have to see these efforts in the context, in this larger context of this very well-resourced effort to shut down the entire grassroots movement for Palestinian rights in the U.S. and internationally. But these BDS laws certainly illustrate this top-down approach to this issue.
Now, I understand, Dima, that some legal challenges to these measures have been brought about by the ACLU. How effective are these challenges, and are we seeing some successes here?
Well, the ACLU lawsuit in Kansas is the first to actually challenge one of these laws, and it is on the basis that these laws violate our First Amendment rights to engage in boycotts to effect social, economic, and political change. There have been several bills, similar bills that have been defeated, including in Maryland. For 3 years in a row, the legislature has failed to pass such an anti-BDS law because of First Amendment concerns and because of a very strong grassroots opposition to this legislation. And that's why we're seeing Governor Hogan going around the legislative process to issue an executive order, just like Governor Cuomo in New York did after such efforts failed in the legislature. So we're confident that the legal challenge in Kansas will prevail, will confirm our First Amendment rights to engage in this kind of political activity, especially at this time when our right to dissent has to be protected more than ever.
We'll wrap up today's show with a clip from a speech given by Professor Gerald Horn, in which he talks about bringing home the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and understanding it in the context of U.S. politics, both historical and contemporary.
But I would be derelict if I failed to note the kinds of contradictions that oftentimes erupt with regard to the solidarity movement. For example, at the beginning of the 20th century, as you probably know, there was a significant migration from what is now Syria, Lebanon, historic Palestine, to the United States of America. And ironically, it seemed as if many of these migrants did not realize they were moving to a separate state, that is to say, the United States of America. They were apparently unaware that their ability perhaps to rise in the class ladder may have had something to do with the fact that you had these supposed permanent occupants of the bottom rungs of the ladder, Native Americans and Africans in the first place, because we were the ones fighting against the settler state, and the settlers felt that we should be punished and pulverized forevermore for being so bold and audacious as to fight against this so-called superpower. And in fact, as I suggest in my 1776 book, one of the reasons why the United States was so open to migration at a certain period, obviously under Donald J. Trump, that policy is under severe revision, but for the longest, one of the reasons why they were so open to migration, particularly from Europe, was because they were fighting this ongoing war with Native Americans and Africans. They needed more numbers. And I'm afraid that some of the folks who were coming to the United States as migrants in the early part of the 20th century were apparently unaware that they could be identified as, quote, white, unquote, and that they were moving to a white supremacist society. And what's interesting is that I mentioned South Africa a moment ago. It would be an interesting project for a student to look at the migration of Jewish people from Eastern Europe to South Africa and how so many of them joined the anti-apartheid cause, not only Joe Slobo, but Ronnie Caswells and many other leaders of the African National Congress, and compare that to folks moving from Central Eastern Europe to the United States and even historic Palestine to the United States and the comparable assimilation issue.
That's going to do it for today. You've been listening to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. Thanks for tuning in. Have a happy new year.
On an intro. This is Judy Ansel, and that is the theme song for Washington Window on Workers, which is our interview with Mark Grinberg in Washington, D.C., about what's going on in labor. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Happy New Year in advance, everybody.
Yeah, I see you haven't taken much break over the holidays, have you?
No, I haven't.
You've been too busy.
Thanks to the zoo that Washington constantly is these days. So
yeah, you've been too busy summing up this last year. You characterize it. I have to quote this: one of the most tumultuous years in U.S. history since World War II has finally dragged to an exhausting end. It leaves workers and their allies with some basic lessons. So let's go through Mark Grinberg's lessons from 2016-17. What are they?
Well, the first one we got is nothing beats plain old door-to-door shoe leather campaigning. There is such a contrast between what happened in 2016 where people dutifully campaigned for the people they supported from Hillary Clinton on down dutifully, but they weren't out there in the droves like they were for Barack Obama. And what happened in 2017, particularly in Virginia and Alabama? There you had people who were energized. They got out on the roads and all sorts of, and it went house to house and all sorts of weather. They really believed in what they were doing. They were both believed positively in their candidates and negatively about Trump. And what you wind up with was a Democratic sweep in Virginia and the Senate race that suddenly turned to the Democrat for the first time in 25 years to the progressive in Alabama.
Well, okay.
There was virtually no organization whatsoever.
Okay, Mark, but I also have to quote my favorite pundit who's on KKFI, Jim Hightower, who once said, "If God intended us to vote, he would have given us candidates." That's my comment on Hillary Clinton. But anyway.
Well, I agree with Jim because that was our second point. Because our second point was she can't beat something with nothing.
Right.
Jones had a message. Civility, decency, moderation, talk, listen. Same thing in Virginia. Same thing with the transgender former reporter who won a state delegate seat in Virginia. Her opponent talked about his bathroom bill. This was a guy who was a 26-year incumbent who was the most anti-gay, anti-everything member of the House of Delegates. She talked about clogged roads. She won. Same thing in Alabama. Jones talked about civil rights, and he talked about helping people with Medicare and Medicaid. More? We know about more. Yeah. If he wasn't trying to repeal half the Constitution, he was busy chasing teenage girls. So.
Right. So I have a message. Right. That's good. Maybe we should try roads in Missouri. I think that might work. Anyway, okay. And your third lesson is?
And my third lesson is that, don't groan, everybody. Campaigns have to be a year round.
I'm groaning.
And I don't mean running for office. I mean out there talking issues. This is what Roem did. This is what Jones did. This is what unions and workers should be doing. We everybody did it when we got out there to support the ACA. This is my fourth point. When we got out there to support the ACA against Trump care. They did, but we didn't do it, or didn't do it enough, on this tax cut for the rich.
Uh-huh. So
that's my point. Yeah.
Okay, so the lesson is that union-favored candidates can win even in this era if they go about campaigning in a different way, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
Take
well, that's hopeful.
Stick to them. And make it in a way that the regular voter can understand. This was Hillary's problem. She was a policy wonk.
Well,
she lost people. Mm-hmm. She was too wonky. She needed to.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure she was too wonky, but I think she took an awful lot for granted and really didn't get out there and speak with people about the issues they cared about.
That's a good point. That's what Jim Gibbs of the mine workers told me just after the election last year.
Right. So, that's a positive and optimistic message for 2018. Thank you very much, Mark, and I hope you're good at predicting the future.
Well, let's hope so. Okay, and thank you, and Happy New Year, everybody, and hopefully 2018 will be a better year for workers and our allies than 2017 was.
Well, Happy New Year to you, Mark Gruenberg, we're going to go on to the calendar now. Thank you. So, the calendar goes into next year, but it starts with December 30th, and this is a just-in-case event. If Trump, which I don't know if he's going to do that in the next 2 days, fires Robert Mueller, there's going to be a rally at either Liberty Memorial or the KCMO Municipal Court, sponsored by Indivisible, at 5 p.m. on December 30th, so stay tuned. Next week, Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meets on Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Church at 4501 Walnut. Empower Missouri is having a Missouri legislative preview. Not going to be a happy occasion, I know. Friday, January 5th, 8 to 10 a.m., Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral, 415 West 13th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. And finally, the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus is sponsoring a forum on gerrymandering, how it works and how it can affect elections. On Tuesday, January 16th at 6 p.m. at Community Christian Church at 4601 Main. To see our calendar, our upcoming shows, or to listen to a past show, go to our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is about the one device, the secret history and moral cost of the iPhone, and panic buttons for hospitality workers in Chicago. Happy holidays, happy new year. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.